Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day on the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify this program with my good guests. My guest today is Richard Geoffroy, who is the founder and maker of Shiraiwa, a sake brewery in Toyama Prefecture, Japan. And before Richard founded the sake brewery in 2018, he was the chef de cave or cellar master at the world-famous champagne producer Dom Pérignon for 28 years. And Richard makes traditional style Japanese sake that is uniquely merged with champagne making techniques, and his sake is gaining the attention of professionals and connoisseurs of sake and wine worldwide. So today we'll discuss why master champagne maker decided to produce Japanese sake, Richard's original style of sake that incorporates the idea of assemblage, how his experience with champagne is inspiring traditional sake production, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And I have a quick announcement. So I am thrilled to let you know that Japan Eats has been nominated for Viewer's Choice for Best Food or Drink Podcast, Viewer's Choice for Best City or Regional Program, and Viewer's Choice for Best Single Topic Series at the 14th Annual Taste Awards. So what is Taste Awards? The Taste Awards is often considered as the Oscars of food, and I'm very honored to be among the incredible nominees and immensely grateful to you, listeners. And I'm asking for your help. So please take a moment to vote for Japan Eats in these three Viewer's Choice categories. Again, it's Best Food or Drink Podcast, Best City or Regional Program, and Best Single Topic Series. And every vote counts. So, and you can cast your vote until February the 17th. And in order to vote, please go to thetasteawards.com. Again, it's thetasteawards.com. And click on the red box, the beginning of the page, submit your viewer's choice votes. So it's all multiple choices. You don't have to remember. You see Japan Eats and click on Japan Eats boxes. So thank you so much for your support. And again, thank you for listening to Japan Eats. Now let's start a conversation with Richard Geoffroy. Hello, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
Right. So I know you are in France. So thank you for joining us to New York. So first of all, to get to know you, where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
Well, I'm born and raised Champenoise. You know, I'm from a family of champagne vignerons, seven generation of grape growing in the south region of Champagne called Côte des Blancs, growing Chardonnay for so many years, so many generations. It has been my scene, my DNA from the start. And what did I eat? You know, actually, for long, you know, it has been country style food. You know, not so urban, not so polished, whatever. Simple food, you know, actually grape growing is farming. It's country style or everything. So I've been coming to more sophisticated food of late, you know, when moving to winemaking, as I will explain.
Right. Well, that's amazing because everything in Champagne to me is a terroir. So it's based on what your surrounding creates. So I think you're part of the terroir too. So
yeah, it's an interesting question, actually. If you look at the wine regions of France, all of them are really about the food, you know, and with the notorious exception of Champagne as far as tradition of food. You know, there is not so much of a local or whatever history of outstanding food. Nowadays is, obviously, because Champagne achieved such a status that it has been drawing so many talents, so many chefs now, but it's all a new recent history of food in Champagne. It's interesting. It just, is it the proximity of Paris? Is it that... For long, the region of Champagne hadn't been really that rich, that bourgeois at all. It was simple food for simple people. You got to understand, to be aware that the current success of Champagne is pretty recent. It's sort of 50, 70 years of thriving and being that successful. People have really... I'm struggling to understand that, you know, Champagne has been around for so long and yet that successful for such a recent period of time.
Right. We kind of have a wrong idea of Champagne is something very expensive and only you drank for something very festive. It's not. It's an agricultural product. Really nurtured over centuries, like you say. So, yeah, we never should see Champagne something kind of unreal. That's really, really.
You get such a point. You know, Champagne is so much of a duality of the terroir and the brand. You know, the terroir, the wine credentials, whatever, the depth. You know, of the people making, growing, and making the. The grapes, the wine, and yet at the same time, it's about celebration. So there is a tension, you know, a duality in all of this, which could be the intriguing beauty of Champagne, actually.
Right. And, well, of course, you spent 28 years as the chef de cave or cellar master at Dom Pérignon. So it sounds like that's the depth and complexity and the purity of Champagne that you spent so long at Dom Pérignon, right? Is that why you spent your almost 30 years in the world of Champagne?
Yeah, frankly, I've been, you know, through the most outstanding and I would say exhilarating wine position in the world, you know, with all due humility, but yeah. Because Dom Pérignon is such a magical project of the wine, of so much outside the wine, the outside world of Dom Pérignon, of Champagne, reaching out to the most outstanding people of the world, all in all, having sort of a vision of the world, you know. So I feel I've been very privileged in the position, but still, in the end, was it a comfort zone? In a way, you know, that and at some stage I started realizing that LVMH was, you know, accepting about anything I was asking for. And it rang to me, you know, saying, yeah, maybe it's about, you know, it. You know, maybe I got to pursue the journey to keep on setting up onto new challenges, you know, reinventing myself in a way. You know, I'm a great believer in the successive lives. You know, right. Life is not one. It comes in chapters, in layers, and so I had to go on.
Right.
To and the then, surprise of so many people. Yeah.
Right. So you really took like the change, like a skydiving equivalent. So, and you retired from your job at Dom de Perignon in 2018 and decided to make sake in Japan, which is a completely the change of your theater to act on. So, you know, I'm sure you have a good reason to make unique decision like that. So why sake? And what was your connection with Japan before you opened the sake brewery?
My move to sake has been the conjunction of one, you know, wanting to break away from champagne, not to say from wine overall. And two, you know, all at the same time, all thanks to Dom Pérignon, you know, developing a fascination for Japan. Something so complex, so intriguingly complex, so many layers, and a fascination for Japan. You know, mm-hmm. that. People are often there in Japan ask me, you know, why so, you know, and I say, well, my friend, it's out of love. It's love for Japan. You know, I hope it's not too embarrassing to my friends there in Japan, but it's the actual truth. So on one hand, I wanted to break away. And on the other hand, I was drawn to Japan in the sense of pursuing a quest, something of a of beauty, of aesthetics, of harmony, and outside wine, and yet the bridges, the correspondences between sake and wine are more than one. Huh? Even the origin, the landscape, not to say the element of the terroir, and the people, the fermentations, the tradition, the innovation, the storytelling, and then obviously, ultimately, eventually, the food. You know, sake is so much about the food. The champagne is aspiring, you know, to go to more and more to the food. So all in all, it was such a natural way to transition from my background of wine into something different enough.
Interesting. So very similar, but very different when it comes to how it's enjoyed. And
I'd love to add that, I hadn't been running into sake right away. You know, I've been going to Japan on many initial occasions. Possibly so busy with my duties of Dom Pérignon, not looking really so much outside the duties. But still, through so many contacts and friends, I've been running into sake. And to say that sake is definitely identity, DNA of Japan. It's in that close to colorless, translucent liquid are all the history, the traditions, the values, the aesthetics, whatever, you know, of Japan. It's a concentrate of so many things in one glass.
Right. That is true. So, okay, that's interesting. Right. I really completely see now how you moved smoothly into the sake world from the world of champagne. So maybe we can just talk about the similarity and differences of sake and champagne in another episode. But I just want to know, you've been fascinated by Japan and the sake. But then I heard you have many friends to make this project happen, to actually build this Shiraiwa Sake Brewery. So what's the connection behind it?
You know, I could easily prime myself and being really having developed an expertise in assemblage in the wine, and hopefully more and more so in the sake. You know, but basically, I'm blending people. Mm. Projects are about the people. Coming up to the Toyama station with my suitcase, you know, lonely, wouldn't work out, you know. So it's so much about the people being able to blend, to unite really goodwill, talents, people who want to be on a journey, an adventure, embarking on it, is really the prerequisite to anything. Before you can drink that that Iwa fire in the glass, you know, there has been a background of so many years and years and years of collecting the right expertise, talents, and goodwill. So, yeah, so it's my pride to start with, even before considering the sake itself. You know, it has been about a partner, Masuda-san in Toyama. It has been collaborations of Kengo Kuma, Mark Musen. It has been about investors from different countries outside Japan. Japan in the first place, but way outside Japan. It has been about local Toyama bankers. It has been about really the local administration of Tateyama in the prefecture of Toyama. It has been about the local administrations, you know, all wanting to help contribute and facilitate the project. So, voilà, what an adventure.
Right.
You know, people don't sometimes think that I'm totally crazy. I must be, yeah, to an extent. You know.
Right. Well,
but this project's about, you know, being crazy enough. It's about a dream. Always is. You know, there must be a dream, you know, as a at the horizon, you know, something you can tend to, you know, so to be drawn to something.
Right.
But setting up in Japan is definitely a challenge. It's climbing a mountain by the northern face, in a way. The icy face of a mountain, but the pleasure, the thrill is up to the challenge. It's very rewarding, and as we speak, after 4 years of activity, you know, one can say it's already, you know, bearing fruit, you know, really showing really great indication of success.
Right. Well, yeah, I feel that you enjoy making sake, not just because of making sake, but also the collaboration. Like you mentioned, Kengo Kuma, the world famous architect, and also the Masuda Shuzo, that's the Masuda Brewery, sake brewery, got advice. And you know, the location talking about, it's Shiraiwa in Toyama Prefecture, which is facing the Japan Sea. So it's just amazing. You have all the you know, elements to make amazing sake brewery. And we'll talk about new facility, the sake brewery too. But we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into Rich Richard's unique sake making philosophy that incorporates the beauty of champagne. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corinne, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corinne is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corinne's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corinne is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corinne.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Saki Kodema, and my guest today is Richard Jaffa, who is the founder and maker of Shiraiwa, a sake brewery in Toyama Prefecture, Japan. And before Richard founded a sake brewery in 2018, he was the chef de carve or cellar master at the world-famous champagne producer Dom Pérignon for 28 years. So, let's dive into your sake. So what is your philosophy of sake making? And is it different from your champagne making philosophy?
Yeah, You know, frankly, before being technical, a project is about a vision and an ambition. And that I've been traveling Japan through Japan for so long, meeting up with so many people, and starting figuring out that Japan had to decidedly make it to the world, that sake was possibly too much of a Japanese affair. And we know that the industry is in a steady decline since early 1970s. So all in all, you know, my dream thing of a sake was really a brand, a sake, which would be deeply probably rooted in Japan and yet able to make it out, reaching out to the world, not to say embracing the diversity or the cultures, the cuisines, the people, you know, developing awareness and success of sake outside Japan. The future of sake is outside Japan. So I would say, therefore, a brand, you know, therefore, sake. Then my belief that the sake got to be special enough to make it really winning thing to the world. So it's the way I've been really coming to, you know, the formulation of a Iwa 5, Iwa's sake.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. You are forward-minded. I think it's a mindset always. That is true. I mean, the future of sake, the sake export has been really the record high thanks to interest abroad. And it's interesting that your way to make something the world class, which is, to me, the same philosophy as making champagne.
Yeah, because, you know, okay, you are very right. You know, in recent years, the exports have been really increasing dramatically, but it's such, from such a small base. As we speak, the export of sake is a mere 5%, and it's not sufficient. The volumes and the value of you know, to the sake industry are definitely overseas. So we as a collectively got to make it, you know, way larger than it is currently is. You know, it's what is at stake. You know, that we got to realize that there were 3,700 breweries in early 70s prior to the oil crisis, and now we are down to 1,200. Mm-hmm. So it's we got to bounce up. You know, and I want to contribute to this. Obviously, it's a project which got to be successful in the sense of being profitable, keeping myself and my investors happy. But there is a purpose above, and it's my sense of love for Japan to contribute to the cause of sake. Mm. You know, my dream in life, you know, I should have said in the first place, and I wanted to move from the status of a visitor to Japan to the one of a contributor. When you love, you contribute. You cannot be a visitor or a passenger, you know, and discussing who knows what. You got to be hands-on and be with the people.
Right.
So I want, you know, humbly, you know, I'm not going to make it alone, but I want to contribute.
I think you're doing it and you really inspired a whole industry. So let's discuss your actual sake, because it's very interesting. So your sake is called Iwa 5. And I'd imagine Iwa comes from Shirayuwa, means rock, the name of the brewery. But why is number 5 attached to it?
Yeah, if we speak of Iwa for a second, yeah, fair enough. Iwa comes from Shirayuwa. Shirayuwa is the name of the site where we established the kura, the brewery. I wanted a name that authentic, representing really a place of the birth of the sake, of the brand, the soul place in a way. And actually, it's even the name of a small village down the, our property. There's a village of, you know, a few tens or 100 people down there. And actually, when you Google out, you Google map out, you find Shira Iwa, you know, Iwa is on the map. You can't point at it on the map. And it's something I was very definite, very keen on. I wanted that element of, you know, the origin you could point at on the map. So
I'll do it later for sure to really zoom in Google map.
And voilà. And then, you know, the five, actually, it's something I've been seeing that five is the universal symbol of harmony in the West, in the East and the West. It's a universal thing. And it's when I say harmony, it's about union and it's about quintessence. And basically, all of this harmony, union, quintessence are my way of expressing assemblage. Mm. You know, instead of, you know, a very generic mention of a sort of a blended thing up front on the bottom is the five, you know, which is a symbol thing of what makes really Iwa five so singular. The salient character mostly is, you know, five is assemblage.
Mm. Okay, so let's talk about the assemblage because many of us are not familiar with the concept of assemblage, which is very, very profound, I think. So what is assemblage and why did you decide to use it for sake making, which is unheard of before? So
assemblage was not really, you know, thought of in the first place. It's more the consequence of a reasoning. I was telling you that Iwa got to reach out to the world, embrace the cultures, the cuisines, and my observation of many years, as much at Dom Pérignon as you know, developing Iwa, is that the only way to make it to the world is to be of superlative balance and complexity. Balance actually makes richness weightless. It's somewhat philosophical in a way. It's a philosophy of taste. Actually, I've been really experimenting through my 28 years of Dom Pérignon, and which is universal, as valid in Iwa as in Dom Pérignon as anything. And I've been thinking that balance and complexity of sake could be worked out to another level, with all due respect to the great sakes of Japan. But I wanted to bring something very personal. You know, I've been telling you of contributing, so not mimicking, you know, the existing, you know, sakes at all. You know, coming up with something from a different angle, a different perspective. So making it to the world implies balance, complexity, and the only way to achieve balance and complexity is really assemblage. You know, working almost sort of a yin and yang thing, the opposite and the complements to make it as a continued from start to finish of the drinking.
Right. So basically, traditionally, sake brewer, brewmaster make one style of what they think is perfect flavor. That's the sake of the brewery. But instead, you're making different types, I mean, different flavored sake, and then you blend each of them. So how many components do you blend from? Like how many, I would say, barrels?
But before getting to just trying to make really the assemblage out, you know, the elements, the number of elements and more, I think that assemblage is definitely pioneering in the industry of Japan. You know, the industry has been 1,200 years of age, and nobody has been, you know, making it, whereas it was all feasible to anybody that, in Japan. So there is that sense of a pioneering, and that this got to be considered together with the process of maturation. You know, originally when we, you know, we launched IWA 5 in the spring of 2020 in Japan, first place, you know, so much about the assemblage. And down the road of close to 3 years now, I realized that the paradigm is more than assemblage alone. It's assemblage cross bottle maturation. One helps the other. You know, the assemblage can only make sense if it's extended, you know, or magnified through the bottle maturation. And bottle maturation makes sense if the base, the original assemblage, got the potential. Voilà. So it's sort of a reciprocal whatever contribution, you know, which makes it so unique, because assemblage is pioneering, and the way I'm looking at bottle maturation is about as much. You know, obviously, there is really that long tradition of koshus, which have been made specifically to the purpose of maturation. And down the road of 12 or 15, whatever, 20 years, here I'm telling you of a really original releases, keeping really improving the bottle, like good wine.
Right. So I really think that, you know, the word used harmony earlier. So by you can assemble, like what I heard is you think blending is different from assemblage. Assemblage is more for targeting harmony. And by maturing, you really confirm that all the elements you blended merged into one to create what you wanted to make as a harmony. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's absolutely correct. Thank you. It's very well put. It's what it is. And my observation of high-end, really superlative, extraordinary sakes of Japan is that the toji, you know, the brewers are willing to, in that realm of Junmai Daiginjos, are willing to make it as fluid, as flowing, as, you know, as a reference to water as possible, which I respect and I actually obviously enjoy. But the project of IWA is very different. Without being really overly provocative, I'm adding substance up. I'm adding richness up. You know, I'm beefing it up. But all thanks to balance from assemblage, that substance, that richness, you know, remains weightless enough. I'm on the conundrum of being really rich and yet weightless enough. Voilà. So it's a very different approach to philosophical approach to the whole thing. I'm an outsider. You know, I'm not from Japan. I never will be. Love for the country and the culture. So I'm bringing my own reading or say interpretation of what sake can be.
Right. Well, I kind of I really feel grateful, even, because that's the inside out mindset you never question as a Japanese person. So, like you said, a Japanese sake tend to be really like pursuing the purity of the flavor that's inherent. In ingredients and how toji makes and all those traditional techniques and mindset. But to me, what sounds like layering different perfected products can enrich the experience of tasting sake.
Yeah, it's a key thing, you know, that sake, in essence, absolutely right, is about the purity of the aromatics. the volatiles and the nose, you know, so much so. And the second thing is that sake is about the flow, the seamless flow of sensations. You know, to me, there is a word I'm so keen on, and which sometimes is seen negatively, but which means so much to me. It's drinkability. That mm-hmm. flow, you know, that way of flowing down the throat, to me, is magical.
Mm-hmm.
There's an element of this in champagne wines. You know, I believe that there should be about as much drinkability in champagne wines as in sake. This well could be the major bridge between the two. So the great brewers, great toshis of Japan are making it as fluid as water, are making it richer and yet weightless enough, flowing enough, seamless enough, smooth enough through the blend, through the assemblage.
Mm.
Voilà. But in the end, it's really being true to the essence of sake, hopefully.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I think the word you describe, you know, the quenchable feeling in your throat, that's, I think, Japanese word called nodogoshi. And nodogoshi yeah. doesn't get used to, you know, it's not used to describe sake experience. It's more like soba noodles or beer. Kind of, and it really enriches the experience of drinking sake, which I think is necessary to revive the sake industry. So that is interesting. I actually, to be honest, yeah. I've never tried a UFI, but I have to try with my, you know, the throat sensation to maximize the experience.
Because the major point of balance is really, you know, the balance, the equilibrium between the palate and the nose. You know, we know that all high-end sakes are more nose than palate, which has been so for so long, you know, so enjoyable. Here, I'm trying to make really it more even, meaning, you know, retaining as much on the nose and, you know, gaining on the palate. You know, another word about this would be palatability, which is a word I love, actually, so much. You know, people just simply, you know, would say presence on the palate. And one of the top sake sommeliers, you know, one is based in Paris. And he told me that iwa is... is sake de bouche. I cannot even translate in English, you know, that meaning that the salient characters of Iwa 5 are more mouthfeel, more palatability than anything.
Interesting. Wow.
Not to mention the finish. You know, that assemblage allows, you know, such a balancing out of the fundamental taste of the sweet, the sour, the bitter, the spicy, the salty, the umami, all the stuff together to make it as continued as possible.
Right.
I've been really on the long discussions there in Japan, you know, with people telling me that sake had to be pretty short-flavored. And I apologize that UFI is about as long-flavored as can be. So, you know, hopefully smooth enough, the glide.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, you know, we mentioned the word nodogoshi, which is not used usually for sake, but, you know, kiregai means like very like short finish, kind of a, you know, ephemeral, like, you know, have to chase that and then you keep drinking to get that taste again. But
yeah.
I think the way you create Iwa 5, it's almost like you're expanding this so-called retronasal and experience, which is always I enjoy because taste experience lasts longer and you appreciate, you know, the value of what I'm drinking. So,
And the to finish off on the profile of Iwa 5 and the challenges, a major challenge to me has been really managing or balancing out the bitterness out. You know, bitterness is one of the main, the major challenges of sake. In all honesty, and I keep telling my peers, you know, was sitting at the Japanese Brewers Association, and we have really open, long, open discussions with our peers. Then locally, the prefecture of Toyama were very active there. And I keep telling them that, whenever people don't like sake, say outside Japan, it's on the grounds, of being overly bitter, which makes it a bit too blunt, a bit too unsettling in a way, and not so easy to take for Western palate. So it's something I've been working out.
Right.
It's there, but just in harmony with all the other tastes.
I think the bitterness probably comes from certain minerals, and depending on which region, it may be more prominent or not. But it's interesting that you said that, because I heard iron makes it a little more bitter, or I don't know. It's so complicated, but
iron is the enemy for certain.
Iron
got to be low.
It sounds like though. It's another complication. Champagne making is very complicated, but which is harder for you, making champagne or sake?
Oh, I'm going to tell you of an anecdote, more than an anecdote, actually, something which happened sometime last year. I gave an extensive interview to Le Monde publication, daily newspaper. A leading one here in France, and the full page interview. I was so happy with this. I could develop my point to the full. And there was that question of comparing really the complications of sake making versus wine making. And I dare to say that sake was more complicated to make, more complex. And there's been an outcry, and I remember it was on a Saturday. On the Monday, I was bombarded with messages, emails. And then I told my friends in the wine industry in France, it's the actual truth. I'm speaking my mind. I really believe, so I say, there are way more options in the making of sake than in the making of wine. Champagne well could be more complicated to make than any other wine. There are more options, more steps, more two fermentations and more, but all in all, sake is well above anything. The level of microbiology in the making of sake is insane. And it cannot be purely science. It cannot be pure science. There is, the guys in Japan are on top of their game. There is really so much knowledge that one can see it so much about experience and empirism as well. Things never happen exactly the way you have been anticipating, because there are too many variables between the composition of the rice, the composition of the water, and the ferment. The microbiology is about really so much of a mystery, so much of the unknown of organic living matter. So, and you were saying that the greatest brewers of Japan are intending to make really sort of a consistent, continued character year in and out without assemblage. And they have my total respect, because there are so many variables that making it really continued enough is such an achievement. It's mind-blowing. So I'm not saying that I'm taking it from a different perspective for a different agenda. But what my peers in Japan achieve is mind-blowing.
What I hear is that for wine, 20% it depends on the quality of the wine. 20% of the wine depends on who makes it. And in Japanese sake, it's like over 60%, 70%. So
I totally agree on this.
Right. Okay. So
yeah, that brings us to the notion of terroir.
Right.
You know, because people keep bombarding me with that question on terroir. And maybe I won't be politically correct there in Japan, but as you said, you know, sake is way more making than sourcing. It doesn't mean that, you know, rice is not important. It's just really the weight of each parameter, you know, the way, well, whereas, you know, in winemaking, grapes are really, sometimes you say, well, 80%, if I understood right. Mm. So, you know, way above 50 in any case. So, and I know there is really an interest, a concern on the rice of the rice terroir in Japan. But to me, if there is really a major strong element of a terroir, it's really a sake terroir.
Mm.
I'm a great believer in sake terroir more than rice terroir.
That is true. And sake also,
terroir is about the kura, is about the brewery.
Right. Yeah. So there are many definitions of terroir, but when it comes to sake, human terroir, people say is a big part of it. So that's interesting.
It sure is.
Right.
No, to me, when I say the kura, it's something, you know, I would say the people in the first day, the first place. We know that, you know, through the different guilds of Toujis across the country, you know, you have different approaches. You know, you don't make the style of Niigata in Niigata, you know, the same way as you do in the down south of Japan, and so on. You know that there's a cultural, individual, human element in the first place. Number two is the water. To me, water is part of the kura. You know, it's making.
I don't know if you know, you are the human terroir, a big part of it now. I'm not sure if you're aware of it now.
Yeah, you know, and actually in one terroir, you know, the men are part of the terroir just as well. The cultural, the dimension, the sensitivity, the personal profile of the maker, everything, you know, it is so important. I put it really first, you know, together with the water. And then the kura itself is about really the layout of the equipment. I've been visiting so many kuras in Japan, I never found the two identical layouts. They're all different. I suspect that there are 1,200 kuras, there must be as many layouts.
Right.
And I'm certain it conditions the final expression of the sake. And third, you know, when you, as for people dealing with the traditional methods of, say, moto, you know, all the yeast propagation methods, yeast starter propagation methods, you know, the microflora of the place, you know, the ambience of the bacteria, whatever within the kura is so important. So, voilà, it's between the man, the water, the equipment, and the microflora. So, I'm a strong believer in the sake terroir, which happens to be the kura.
Right. Okay. Well, speaking of, I didn't get a chance to go to, you know, details of this new kura. You've been making sake with your friend, advisor brewery, Master Sake Brewery, but you opened really beautiful new sake brewery in April 2021. And it's designed by Kengo Kuma, the world famous architect and your close friend of yours. So, It sounds like it's a new place and a new experience. So how do you describe that brewery? Like, you know, is it space that kind of present new opportunity to discover sake, or what kind of space is that?
But believe it or not, Kengo Kuma never had been never designed a cooler, you know, at all. And for him, it was so important, being really a proud Japanese, you know, architect of Japan, you know, designing a sake brewery. A cooler was of major, outstanding importance. Mm. You know, so number one, so he was very involved, well, very committed. And on the other hand, you know, I explained that commissioned, you know, can go to design really something of the future. I wanted something, you know, showing good faith and confidence in the future of sake, sending the message to Japan, to my peers in the industry, before even thinking of, you know, the followers and lovers of Iwa, making it a destination. I wanted it to carry an element of modernity without betraying anything of DNA in a sense, but still progressive in a way. Voilà. So it's the, you know, I wanted sort of a ship. Mm. I had the dream of a vessel, you know, people could embark onto. And the revelation to me when has been when together with Masuda-san and Kengo Kuma, we have been visiting really local traditional farms, be it in Fukui region or, you know, in Nanto district up north of Toyama Prefecture, that there were those, there are these traditional farmhouses, one big body of a building, sheltering everything, everybody, the owner, the family, the staff, the cattle, the food to the humans, to the animals, the crop, everything, and everybody surround, you know, getting around the earth, that sort of central social place of the building. And actually, I've been really, you know, expressing that that philosophy to Kengo, who has been really so much of a master in making the dream true. And Kengo has been coming up with the concept of everything under one single roof, meaning that, you know, it's obviously so much production. It's the only one and only place of making for, you know, the entire production of Iwa under our control, with the most outstanding toji you could think of. And at the same time, we can receive, we can welcome people of Japan and of the world just as well. Mm. And the guests are treated the same way as the workers, or the workers on the same standards as the guests. Mm. It's one floor, one platform. Symbolically, it's the same material from the guests to the workers. It's really that ash from local wood, all blended together with a concrete. That's all dark gray thing, which again unites, you know, the production and the reception. Mm. It's what it is.
Wow. Well, hopefully I get lucky to be able to visit the brewery. This sounds amazing. So also, I think our listeners want to know where they can get IWA Iwa 5 available. And, you know, it's in where, in which country? We have a lot of listeners in many countries. It's up to 190 countries all worldwide. So where can we get Iwa 5?
Yeah. We launched Iwa 5 in the spring of 2020 in Japan. Then in the summer, we extended to parts of Asia and gradually to the full of Asia, and then moving to Europe. And then finally, last but not least, I would say America. So we have been really available in America since November of 22. In all, we're in 31 countries as we speak. Very strong, very highly recognized and you know, great notoriety in Japan, and outstanding, tremendous response in America as we speak. The rest of Asia is a bit more patchy as far as success is concerned, because COVID has been really, you know, a challenge to many countries. You know, whenever, you know, looking at China or Hong Kong, there has been a struggle. But we have many supporters, and I think they will be back on, you know, pretty rapidly. Europe is slow and will remain slow enough for long, because the recognition, the awareness of sake is less. So we have that groundwork to achieve and to make it at the highest level of anything. And America is so aware enough of sake to respond to IWA. And it's an exhilarating period of in developing the brand and the recognition. It's just it's such a thrilling experience of seeing it, you know, expanding out, growing, developing, and like a kid, you know, like a baby. You see, starting walking and getting more and more confidence and being really growing up in a way. It's such an element of a satisfaction. Mm. Hard work, but it still is.
You know? Right. So what's
your No, I wanted to complete my point and say that I was telling you that it is so much reaching out to and embracing the different cultures of the world and their cuisines. It's so much about the cuisines, and the ambition of IWA 5 is definitely to be such an in harmony with the great cuisines of the world. You know, way outside Japan. We are obviously probably Japanese in the first place, but we got to crack that box of that perimeter of Japanese gastronomies out to all great cuisines with no exception. And actually, as we speak, not even 3 years on the marketplace and the COVID and everything, we're already in 43-star restaurants of the world as we speak.
Wow.
Nine of them being Japanese means that 31 are non-Japanese.
Oh, that's amazing.
I believe it's an achievement. Yeah, I think it is an achievement, but I believe it is. Yeah. And the follow-up from the chefs, you know, sommeliers, you know, have been keen on sake for long enough. They are so supportive of sake wherever. But the chefs, I'm very intrigued. You know, in my own life, the chefs were not really so wine guys, so much of a wine guys. They were even managing a distance between their creative work and the wine. Maybe, I don't know, being suspicious on wine, being, you know, maybe altering really their work of food, I don't know. You know, on a more competitive mode, I'm still trying to make it out. But sake, you know, in general, and the IWA 5 in particular, chefs are way more relaxed, you know, and keen and open and curious. So it's really great news. It's something the industry got to, you know, to work out for certain.
Well, I look forward to seeing, we're going to keep creating and keep inspiring, not just the Japanese sake industry and consumers, but it sounds like the whole world. So good luck. And so where can we find your updates online and on social media?
So we're on Instagram, you know, it's iwa.sake. And we have a site, you know, where you can really have all the fundamentals of the brand and having really all the descriptions of the sake and more. And it's on iwa-sake.japan, JP.
Okay, great. So iwa-sake.jp.
Yeah.
Great.
Voilà.
Right. Great.
And yeah, such a pleasure. You know. And I want to embark more and more people on the adventure. You know, the journey. I see the whole thing as a sort of a journey. And the way people of Japan have been responding to EY is amazing. The one thing people have been commenting on is really that they experience a new sensation. It's, you know, many people say, well, we can see really some of the traditional characters of sake. In the same time, it's revamped, reshuffled, reorganized into something which is totally unprecedented. So, and people are really following up, you know, they are so supportive.
Right. It's a refreshing idea, kind of rediscovery. Myself, I grew up very traditionally, and my father was drinking traditionally too. So, yeah, I'm so grateful. And please keep me posted. You can come back on maybe new release or any new product you come up with. You can come back and discuss.
Yeah, at the moment we are really one sake, one single sake, but we'll expand out. You know, it won't be vast expansion. You know, but if we could come up with two or three sake down the road of a few years, I think I'm able to tell everything of EY through three sakes with that concise. That, voilà, here's the project. It
great.
Should keep me busy for long.
I can see that. So good luck, and thank you so much for joining us today, Richard.
Thank you. It has been a tremendous pleasure. Thank you.
Right.
More to come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short episode guests, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japaneats is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. My engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.